This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 19th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Nick Seabrook sits down with Deblica Gwynn, the Executive Director of Access to Media Education Society, or AIMS. The two discuss the work the organization does to educate and empower youth through storytelling, artistic collaboration, and peer facilitation. To learn more about Deblica and the work she does with AIMS, take a listen.
Deblica, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me.
First, let's start with some introductions. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about your personal history and the work that you do?
I think I've always been interested in power differentials as even a young person, and spent a lot of time at university sort of deconstructing how power is unevenly distributed. And I think I wanted to be involved with something that was creative, so that to blend sort of the deconstructive act of looking at inequities, power inequities, and actually making things. So that was part of the draw to being involved with representational redress, where young people whose stories had been either misrepresented or invisibilized by the media could gain the tools to reclaim and reframe the telling of their own stories. And I guess in the act of doing that, actually make something positive, so that the idea of the making and bringing forth in a positive way, as well as the deconstructing. And I ended up, I came out west to go to grad school at SFU and got ill and thought I'd take a semester off of school. So came over to Galliano and then got involved with the starting of the film school there. So it just sort of evolved that gave an opportunity, because I was there for that, to actually help develop an organization that would work with marginalized communities to do that kind of storytelling about a lot of things, but about how different systems have impacted their lives. And then to pay that forward in terms of helping other people understand the impacts and consequences of different systems.
You know, you're not just the executive director at AIMS, Access to Media Education Society. You're also the founder. Can you tell me a little bit about that history of how AIMS came to be?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's sort of a matter of, you know, happenstance. You know how sometimes your life makes sense in reverse. But I mean, I came over here for a little detour. It was just supposed to be a sidebar to getting back to my life in the city. And then, as I said, I got involved with it. It just so happened there was a lot of interesting creative thinkers that were out here. And my next door neighbor ended up starting a film school that was about like sort of a media boot camp for a week that people would come out and make videos. And I really enjoyed that process. I saw the potential. It was quite profound to see people dive into storytelling. And I wanted to be able to run programs that were similar, but that were specifically geared towards communities of young people who were from historically underserved or historically marginalized communities, that specifically a lot of their harms came through media. So that idea of using media to correct harms in terms of where stereotypes were perpetuated, and also the idea of coming together and sort of decolonizing stories that you've been told about yourself, and kind of doing that transformative shifting work to telling stories from your own perspective and actually kind of believing that your stories matter. And that was the beginning of like shifting to doing fully subsidized programs. We became a registered charity in order to raise money to be able to offer programs fully subsidized that were much more kind of intentionally curated for healing, I guess, to create community-based spaces that were safe spaces to reflect upon their lives and do some sort of community building and healing, and then learning how to the skills to make a movie and in short with other peers, short format.
So a little bit more specifically, what are some of the harms that Ames is looking to address or help heal through its curriculums?
Well, I mean, the stories, I mean, we sort of set a general frame, but it really ends up being up to the young people. It's been a wide range. A lot of them fall under the general banner of social justice and climate justice. A lot of them are about, you know, ways in which, whether it be about, you know, sort of course of assimilation for new immigrants, whether it's extractive and genocidal practices against Indigenous people, intergenerational trauma, how that's impacted families, everyday racism and microaggressions. You know, the latest offering we have is Crossroads, and the primary themes it addresses is Indigenous-specific racism, Black-specific racism, classism, and homophobia and transphobia. And basically, a lot of what happens when we start the writing process with young people, there is a level of wish fulfillment about, like, because a lot of the work that we do gets shown in high school environments or in school environments. So there's a level of wish fulfillment about, like, what do you wish your peers knew then? How might that change the way you were treated or your history was understood or not understood? So a lot of that is writing into the gaps, writing into, you know, some of the harms people have experienced, whether just from microaggressions to like disproportionate discipline to tone policing. There's sort of a wide range. And a lot of it starts with interpersonal, but it kind of, then we kind of shift the focus to systemic. And in terms of a lot of the other, you know, a lot of our programming is some program that we do here is also about how practices have disconnected people from culture and the land. So a lot of there is also using digital media to restore knowledge of plants and medicines to as a way to ground cultural and language revitalization efforts. So so we want, as more and more, we want to start bringing in how it's not just about how certain systems have divided us against each other, but it's about how it's divided us from the human, from the more than human world and from the land.
All right. And you mentioned the Crossroads program, which is your latest piece of curriculum that you've developed. But more broadly, how do you go about developing and creating your curriculum? And, you know, what's, you know, the experience from start to finish? Like, do students always have sort of a project that they want to complete by the end, like in terms of a video or something like that? Just sort of take me a little bit into the process.
Yeah, it's the Crossroads is a little bit different because it's a video game. It's an interactive graphic novel and involves a lot of coding. It was a much longer arc. But generally speaking, so it was a similar process, but it just took longer with the video game. But generally speaking, young people come together. They figure out in a wide circle what are the kinds of issues that are really that they want to bring forth, and we make teams based on that and assign them with appropriate mentors, and they usually have a week to 2 weeks to create a story that they think will be engaging to young people. And then we're very privileged to have a kind of a group of activists and educators who work with Ames, and then we tend to build lesson planning around what they've created that will help, depending on what the tone is. Maybe it's about increasing emotional literacy to prepare yourself to have creative, courageous conversations. Maybe it's about helping to understand the relationship between internalized, interpersonal, and institutional and systemic ways these different isms that we're talking about show up. It sort of depends. We kind of try to take our cues from the video, because usually, of course, in any video that someone is sharing about an ism they've experienced, there's going to be opportunities to pull from that to look at how that impacts people, again, internally, interpersonally, and systemically.
So speaking about the Crossroads program, I believe that was launched earlier this year, correct?
Well, it's the beta launch happened. We're actually going to officially release it into schools this fall, but we've been testing it. We did a very extended beta because it was really, really important to see if it was working in schools, to test it with the audiences. There's the makers. So young people are involved in making it. but it was sort of like, how is it on the receiving side? So we did a very extensive year-long beta test that over 600 teachers and students got a chance to experience Crossroads. And then it's going to be officially released this fall. We've just got a whole bunch of new youth facilitators, also from equity deserving communities or historically marginalized. And they're going to be taking the game out into schools.
And just behind the creation of the Crossroads program, was that done because, you know, you haven't had a program that focused on video game as a medium in storytelling? Or what was the driver behind the creation of this program?
Well, like so many things during the pandemic, part of it was we really couldn't gather in large groups to do video, which is more in person. So it was a combination of what was happening at that time with the murder of George Floyd, with the uncovering of the grave sites and residential schools. There were so many things that were going on in terms of the racial pandemic, plus we couldn't, racism pandemic, plus we couldn't meet. So the idea was, well, this is something that we could use a story-based approach to create something that would enable us to collaborate remotely, but would also enable students to do it as a classroom and also do it independently. Now, by the time the game came out, people weren't having to learn at school. It was, the game is available. You know, one way of doing it is showing the game on a projector and having everyone kind of go through, and it's a choose your own adventure, pick different responses. So you can do that as a whole class, but it's also available as an app for Android and iPhones or iOS phones and devices, iPads, so that people can do some private looking through and looking at the impacts and consequences of different ways of responding to different sort of awkward moments that come up with friends where there's a gap in there's a power differential, and then witnessing how it happens with the characters and then reflecting on how that might impact, how that might relate to people's own life experience.
And, you know, looking on the Ames website, I was doing some research for this interview and just seeing, you know, how long Ames has been in operation. I believe it's been going since the mid-90s. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've had about 50,000 people go through your programs in that time.
Yeah, it's, well, I don't know about 50,000. We've had certainly, that's the thing. There's sort of like different, there's the making of the videos, and then there's the people who then experience it. So I guess if you include the workshops, probably over 50,000, because then you've got the deep impact of the making of the projects, and then the training up of youth facilitators who build a community. So it's concentric circles of impact, and then going out into classrooms and then having teachers download it and use the videos on their own. So the reach gets wider and wider that way.
And over the years, whether it's been teachers or been students, what has been some of the great, you know, feel good, positive feedback that you've gotten, you know, that maybe sticks out in your mind as some of your favorite reactions or responses to Ames's work?
I mean, I'll look at the different phases from the making stages to have young people. So young people come and they're gathering to participate in this camp, but they don't really believe that their stories matter. And so to actually witness the transformation of young people, you know, their first impulse is often to create a story that replicates what's in the mainstream media and to try to coax people back to the what's actually alive and real in their lives. And at first it's like, well, that doesn't really matter. So going through that process of having people really believe that their stories do matter and seeing that shift and what happens in people's body language and people's confidence when they move out of a place of kind of deep internalized shame about their life experiences to a place where it's like, yeah, I actually am quite resilient. I've survived a lot. I starting to just self-acknowledge the value of their stories and how telling your story could actually change things for other people. And suddenly people sort of go into an empowered place where it's like, I could actually help other people have a better experience in school. So I've just seen countless numbers of times of actually witnessing that seminal moment of believing their stories matter, and also people's first moments of creative fulfillment where they're like, well, just learning the technology. Like that is that the hands-on skills building, you know, where it's just like, oh, like especially with the editing process, it's like, oh, this is, you know, at first it's just like, ugh. And then when people start to gain a little bit of literacy with the skills, realizing what's possible and also realizing that they will never look at the media again. That's a whole interesting thing. Cause then you start to really understand what we're talking about. Like when you look at the editing process, you're like, yeah, it really matters how things are edited. And you are on the receiving of that. And as a consumer of media, a lot of the time, that's from a making point of view. From a when we do outreach in schools, you know, we often started with high school because a lot of the content is kind of a little bit older. Mm-hmm. But I think back in 2011, I think it was around then that they made it so that you could, or at that point it was could, not should, talk about the residential school experience as early as in grade four. And we started doing workshops with a few young classes. And, you know, and this is stories from the youth facilitators. I wasn't there. But seeing young people like have the light go off about what this actually happened, like, and, you know, really have a first moment of kind of understanding that the world can be an unkind place, but it being shared in a way with young people who are saying, let's learn from this. Let's not shy away from it. Let's learn from this, or those seminal moments, because young people in their own way are really, really young people are primed for justice. When you start talking about foundational principles like power and privilege, to have that moment where people are like getting that concept and coming up, and they were like a young person standing up and going, I guess privilege is the fact that I always come to school well fed and I have a really good lunch. Mm-hmm. And I have that privilege. Like just realizing how those concepts are alive in their everyday living. And you just imagine the world being governed by adults who understood these concepts at a really young age and didn't shy away from it. And understood that, yeah, it's a little bit incumbent upon us to whatever aspect of our lives that we have surplus to share with others or be aware of our privileges and then find a way to meaningfully that works with each of our own personalities, work with that or against it in some cases.
And, you know, understanding privilege and justice and empathy right now is so important. Unfortunately, in some provinces in Canada, like Alberta, New Brunswick and Saskatchewan, we've seen over the past year some implementations of restrictions in schools around youth being able to use their correct pronouns, you know, allowing teachers to dead name transgender students in those provinces. I was just wondering, in light of those developments this past year in those provinces, how does that make you feel about the importance of the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, so there's one of the storylines that I said, it's homophobia, transphobia, one of the lines, the storylines in the parent rights movement hadn't reached the fever pitch by the time we were doing it. I mean, you know, transphobia has been with us for a long time. And part of what we wanted to do with that storyline is to help, again, have a character speak the fear, like, you're too young to, like, you know, get a sex change. And then, you know, back it up and go, well, first of all, like, let's, number one, that's not what I'm trying to do. So to try to give voice to the fear mongering, and then and dial it back. And so that, again, you can understand, you start to understand the wider context of it's actually not this. They're like, just because I want to change my pronouns doesn't mean this. So debunking a lot of the myths, talking about gender affirming care, just having someone be able to articulate their own ambiguity. Like, so you're humanizing the process. You're trying to give language and vocabulary to what is gender affirming care? Why do pronouns matter? And, but it's not, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that impacts whether we can do this program. So ironically, when we started doing this in 2002, we did a program that was anti-homophobia and anti-racism together. And we sometimes had to make presentations to the PACs to get permission to go into the schools for the anti-homophobia. So that ended up, particularly when we did a rural speaking tour, we had to get permission from the parents. at 2002. Then after that, then it was sort of the anti-racism was sort of more triggering to people because of the backlash around, you know, critical race theory, or we've talked about race too much. It's, you know, now we're the minority. And then now again, we're back to, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this program, because I mean, I think it's never been more important to give teachers resources that enable them to crack the ice on these conversations. But also, you know, as we're developing a teacher's guide, we're realizing we need to actually equip teachers with resources around like what to say to parents or what to say to principals, because in some provinces, the parents are going to say, I don't want my student to participate in any of these programs. And again, to sort of have a little bit of, here's some notes about the idea that knowledge is power. It's not about converting, it's about understanding. I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see how this program rolls out in the backdrop of extreme backlash that in. And it's an interesting challenge for us and the youth facilitators to try not to meet moments of hate with hate, you know. And that's the really interesting is to try to coax into curiosity. That's why it's like naming the fears. Like, even though when I see some of the fear mongering and hate mongering that's happening with the rise of the parent rights movement, it's infuriating. But it's also, I want to go like, well, what are the drivers of that? Like, oh, these are parents who are afraid that they're not going to be able to relate to the fear. So it's like trying to, with the young people in the classrooms and the teachers and the parents, like, let's actually have those courageous conversations about like, what are you afraid of? And it's like, it's, you know, I understand, I'm a parent, I understand the impulse to control when you're afraid. And this is that impulse sort of written into law. It's frightening.
If someone who's listening wants to learn more or maybe wants to take part in one of your programs, how can they do that?
Yeah, if you go to our website, accesstomedia.org, there you'll find information about all our programs. If you go to workshops or crossroads, there'll be those. Both of those will lead you to how you can demo the game and book a workshop.
Wonderful. Deblica Gwynn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay, thank you so much, Nick. I appreciate it.
That was Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and Deblica Gwynn, the executive director of Access to Media Education Society, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Nick and Deblica. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things back over to Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, unions in Saskatchewan are joined together to fight the province's discriminatory Bill 137, which targets trans youth. The bill requires that trans youth receive their parents' permission in order to have their correct pronouns used in school. The legislation has faced backlash as it ignores the fact that some trans youth do not have supportive parents. Bill 137 is currently facing a legal challenge in the courts, and the Canadian Union of Public Employees Saskatchewan, the Saskatchewan Federation of Labour, and the Canadian Teachers Federation are all petitioning to intervene in the case on behalf of trans youth and their members. The unions are arguing that Bill 137 is requiring teachers to intentionally harm their students. Studies by the U.S. federal government's National Institute of Health found that when trans youth are addressed using their correct pronouns, it dramatically reduces incidence of suicide. In national news, a report published earlier this week by the American Medical Association is highlighting the damage that frequently moving residences can do to children. The report found that incidents of depression rose in children who had had to move from their home frequently. This highlights growing concerns around the impact that Canada's unstable housing market is having on public health.
the ability to buy a home has moved further and further out of reach for many Canadians. Between June of 2022 and June of 2024, inflation for mortgage rate interests has shot up by 74%. The rental market has also seen volatility, with the rate of eviction notices rising by around 300% between 2017 and 2022. The Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions is calling on federal and provincial governments to better fund public health systems so that they can adequately address growing public health issues. And finally, political leaders across the world reacted to the attempted assassination of former U.S. President Donald Trump this past Saturday, including Alberta Premier Danielle Smith. Alberta politics contributor David Kleimenhage said that Smith's calls for the left to tone down its alleged violent rhetoric was dripping with hypocrisy. Earlier this year, a gunman opened fire in Edmonton City Hall, a stronghold for Smith's rival NDP, and Smith never released a statement condemning the attack. Instead, the day after the shooting, she attended an event for far-right American political commentator Tucker Carlson. Kleimenhage pointed out Carlson's long history of defending violence when it is targeted against immigrants and other minorities. Danielle Smith is also yet to call out Donald Trump for his calls for violence against progressives, who he has called vermin. As always, you can read all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
In 2024, many indie news media organizations are making the hard decision to close up shop. But with your support, Rabble.ca can continue to share news for the rest of us for years to come. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on YouTube. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your local radio station? It's easy. For more information, get in touch with me, Brianne Doyle, at brianne@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Radio Rewind.